This is Spectator Radio, and you're listening to Women with Balls, presented by Katie Balls.
Hello, and welcome to Women with Balls, where I talk to today's trailblazers. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Victoria Atkins. Atkins is a minister in the Home Office, where her brief is crime, safeguarding, and vulnerability, and she is also the Minister for Women. Since taking on the role, Atkins has played a lead role in the government's new Domestic Abuse Bill and the Offensive Weapons Bill. She recently became talk of the MP's tea room for reportedly reading the Riot Act to Boris Johnson for suggesting funds spent investigating historic child abuse amounted to spaffing money up the wall. Atkins has been described as a Tory rising star, was the first of her intake to be promoted to a ministerial role, and prior to entering Parliament, she worked as a barrister. So, thank you very much for joining us today, Victoria.
Thank you, Casey.
I think you're also, from on a podcast level, perhaps the busiest guest we've had on. Because we have tried to record this podcast, I think, four times. And today you had another urgent question.
Yes, yes. My daily urgent question, as we like to call it. Yeah, yeah.
So before we get to your current brief, there was much to talk about there. On this podcast, we like to start by going back, rewinding the hands of time to what you were doing before you were in politics. And I guess just starting on your early life, we had Jess Phillips on the podcast recently, and she was talking about how she grew up in a very political household where she was sent on marches most weekends opposing nuclear weapons, and it was a very socialist family. You had a slightly different scale of the political spectrum. Your father, Sir Robert Atkins, is a former Conservative MP and MEP, and you said that John Major has known you since you were born. So is it fair to say you grew up in a political household?
Yes, I think that is fair. I have to thank the Conservative Party for me existing, because my parents met at Conservative Party conference, and so I'm very grateful to the party.
But that's one of the happier, probably, Conservative Party conference romances.
Yes, very much so. Every year, whenever I speak, I'm always saying to the young people there, who knows, you may have met Mr. and Mrs. Wright.
Yeah, all my, not personal tales, obviously, but the things we hear are kind of the drunken late night encounters. So I'm glad that there is a wholesome story coming from what is often a bit of a booze fest. Did you talk about politics much in your household, or were you, as children, left to come up with your own views?
I mean, we did, you know, over the dinner table. I think in any family, if whether it's teaching or medicine or whatever, you talk about the family business, as it were. And of course, I was sent out to canvass and deliver leaflets from the age of zero. My mum used to use the pram to balance the leaflets in as she was going around delivering. And I was convinced at the age of seven, with Margaret Thatcher being prime minister at the time, I thought that's what women do. They become prime minister. So it seemed to me utterly normal to talk about politics, and is probably why I decided in my teenage years to just give it a break and not join the Conservative Association at university, because I'd had enough politics for the time being.
And you never went through the rebellious teenage phase, which I guess in that kind of environment would see you become a socialist, join the Communist Party and really rebel to your parents.
I didn't go that far. We did have some pretty heated exchanges on, I remember there was a road decision that my father had made when he was Transport Minister, and I felt quite angry about that because it had environmental impact, as I saw it at the time. So there was, they brought me up well to argue properly, I hope.
And then from there, you went to university and studied law at Cambridge. And at that point, was your, I guess, your vision or your ambition to become a lawyer or barrister as you went on to?
Very much so. I wanted to be a criminal barrister. I loved the criminal courts. I still do. I think that we are so lucky to have the jewel of the justice system that we do in this country. And some of my earliest memories, happiest memories, were sitting in the public gallery of the Old Bailey and watching how people made sure that guilty people were convicted and innocent people were acquitted.
And then your experience of law in the years you were doing it, was it what you expected it to be?
It was even more varied than I imagined. I mean, if you think the criminal justice system, whether it's youth courts, magistrates courts, or the highest courts, crown courts, etc., you're dealing with some of the biggest problems facing society. So I did everything from robberies in youth courts through to, in my later years, prosecuting serious organised crime. And so it's been a really great grounding for politics, because I've seen very much what harm can be done. And for me, I got to a stage where, I was conscious that by the time I'd got involved, harm had been done, and I wanted to get in at an earlier stage of the process to try and stop that harm from happening.
And then at what point did you think, this is a very fulfilling career, but I want to try something different and I want to go into politics?
Well, one of my first cases was, I was sent to a youth court in the southeast, and I just had a post-it note of the name of the young person I was looking after, and I got to court. He was 12 years old. He had no grown-up with him, no mum, no dad, no carer, and he was in court for the first time. And I said to him, you know, is anyone coming to look after you, mum or dad? And he said, I've never known my dad, and my mum will be flat out drunk on the floor by now. It was 9:30 in the morning, and I thought at that point, I want to be able to do something in later life to help boys like that and children like that. Fast forward 10, 15 years, David Cameron threw open the candidates list in the wake of the expenses scandal, and my husband said to me, for goodness sake, stop shouting at the television whenever Gordon Brown comes on. You know, put your money where your mouth is, put yourself down. So I did, and it was a lengthy process. It was a long application process, but I was very lucky to be selected for the seat of Louth and Horncastle, and I've absolutely loved being the Member of Parliament.
Yeah, and but prior to that seat, you ran to be Police and Crime Commissioner, right? And I think narrowly missed out. Is that the right way to put it? Or was that kind?
No, I mean, I did, because I think the system of Police and Crime Commissioners actually is a really good system, and they can make a real difference in their local communities. I think I won the first round, but because it wasn't first past the post, it went to the second round, and I lost to the Independent.
And then you were also lined up in 2010 for a different seat, but I think it was also a safe seat.
I was very lucky. I got interviewed in a number of seats and lost to fabulous people like Claire Perry, Sajid Javid, Joe Johnson. So, you know, all the great people. They've all beaten me.
Because I was just wondering, because there's certain MPs who really pride themselves. So I think James Cleverly is one of them, Johnny Mercer to this day because of his currency. And then Andrea Leadsom, when she was on this podcast, he really prides themselves on, you know, fighting those no hope seats. So there's almost like a certain faction in the Tory party who think you have to do that to get your campaigning noose. And I was wondering what you made of that, because it seems that you didn't have to go through the marginal seat route.
No,
was that a conscious decision?
I think running a Police and Crime Commissioner election where you're fighting not one constituency but seven is quite good experience, to be honest.
Now, since entering Parliament, you've been quite quickly promoted, but I guess initially just 2015, and obviously surprise result, Tory majority. It was probably from your perspective, a happier environment than you first imagined in that campaign, when I think everyone was very sceptical of the fact that David Cameron would get a majority. What surprised you on entering Parliament? What didn't you expect to be the case then?
Well, that's a good question. I think, first of all, that try as you might, preparing for the fact that on the Thursday you've got polling day, Friday morning, as in my case, because Louth and Horncastle is such a rural seat, you have your result declared. And then Monday, you are straight into the House of Commons as the Member of Parliament. It's that speed of turnaround that I think most new MPs find quite surprising. What else have I found surprising? The labyrinth of the House of Commons surprises everyone. Last week discovered a lift that I had no idea existed on my way up to the committee corridor. And it's so you very much learn about the environment. But the environment, I think, in a way, the palace is such an important part of our experience as MPs, because it's a constant reminder as to the huge privilege of being a Member of Parliament, and also the history that precedes you and will carry on long after you've gone.
Yeah, I still get lost to this day. Yeah. I share your points in the press gallery. And when we get to that promotion, so you were PPS to the Leader of the House of Lords, and then I think around the time that Priti Patel left the cabinet, things got shuffled around a bit, and you were moved to your current brief in the Home Office. And I think at the time it got quite a lot of press because you were the first of the 2015 intake to get to that point. I think, as everyone probably suspects or knows, it's quite competitive politics. Would you say all your colleagues were delighted for you?
In fairness, actually, they were all really lovely, actually. I mean, I was very lucky to be promoted, and I particularly promoted into this role because it really is my dream role. You know, it's very much about drawing on my experiences in the criminal courts and looking at the causes of crime and so on. So I actually, everyone was really lovely, and I got inundated with text messages and lots of cups of tea and something stronger bought for me. So they were very lovely.
The brief you currently have is very diverse, and I mean the Home Office as a whole, as just seeing from the various urgent questions, you have so much on your plate. What in terms of your brief have you found, I don't know, perhaps the most rewarding part so far?
The most rewarding part, but also the most difficult part, is meeting the victims of crime, because, you know, the sorts of crimes that we're dealing with in the Home Office, everything from knife crime through to child sexual exploitation to domestic abuse, that the victims of those crimes and their families have the most extraordinary stories to tell. And I think for me personally, it's just really important to keep listening to people in that position, because actually this is why we're here. This is what we're doing this all for, to try and help people. So that to me is the most important part.
I was looking at the domestic abuse bill, which took a while to get to the point it did, partly because of Brexit. I think I remember doing a radio programme with you where you came on to talk about it. I think it was Penal's Politics.
Oh, yes.
And there's just so much Brexit happening that you just had to plead to just get two sentences out about the bill.
And John was very good, in fairness.
Is that a constant dilemma in this parliament, yeah, with Brexit versus obviously domestic issues? Do you find it an uphill battle to get domestic issues movement on them?
I mean, it is difficult. I think everybody acknowledges that. What was great though about the domestic abuse bill was the interest that there was actually in the media to talk about it, because I think, you know, most journalists are responsible people with friends and families, and, you know, they understand how they can help us communicate these really important public messages. So I was really struck actually at how responsible the huge majority of journalists and media outlets were on that.
Yeah,
we did talk about it, didn't we? If you remember,
we did. And one of the things in that bill was the idea of financial abuse. For listeners who perhaps aren't up to date yet with how that has changed, how does the domestic abuse bill basically stretch out to cover probably what people don't traditionally at least see as domestic abuse?
Yeah, so what we want to do, we're reflecting in the bill, we've got a statutory definition that reflects the enormous range of abuse and the types of abuse there are. So most people who haven't been affected by domestic abuse probably think about physical violence, but actually if you work with victims of domestic abuse, you learn very, very quickly that it can take many different forms, everything from mental and emotional abuse to financial abuse. And this is, we've called it quite deliberately economic abuse, because we want to emphasise the point that this is about their access to economic powers, such as being able to feed yourself, being able to use the money you've earned to buy your own clothes, making sure that you can access your mobile phone and not be cut off from your friends. These are all examples that victims have given us of ways in which their partner sought to control them and cut them off from their friends and families.
Now, looking at some of the other issues that have come up in the past year, which I think would fall into your role as women's minister, we have had upskirting, and we've also recently had an FGM bill. And in both of those instances, there's also one of your colleagues who sometimes comes up, Christopher Chope.
Object!
Who has a tendency to object on the reading and then basically pushes, or at least tries to push, things into long grass. Do you sometimes feel frustrated at the behaviour of perhaps a colleague like Chope, that they do these things, and obviously all the headlines just say Conservative MP blocks upskirting bill? And just in case people don't know what upskirting is, it's taking photos of someone's skirt. So on the surface, it doesn't seem like the most obvious thing to block.
Yes, it's incredibly frustrating, and I don't quite know why Christopher does it, not least because he has lots and lots of private members' bills himself that he seems very keen to get through.
The official reason he gives is scrutiny.
I mean, I find it incredibly frustrating, particularly for all the campaigners who worked so hard on upskirting, but also the campaigners who work on tackling FGM. We want to get this legislation through. and I think, you know, I believe in the private members bill system. I think it's right that members of parliament should be able to put forward pieces of legislation that they care deeply about. And we've had some great successes recently. I mean, Sarah Wollaston has worked to bring forward the stalking protection orders, which will really help victims of stalking from getting protection from those who are acting in a criminal way. So they can really work, but it's incredibly frustrating when these sorts of headlines are coming up rather than the right headlines, which is we're doing something to stop this.
And almost along those lines, I'd touched on it in the introduction, which was a story from my colleague Isabel Hardman, which has been doing the rounds in the media. In the voting lobby last month, several of your colleagues reported that you used that time to confront Boris Johnson after he had made a comment that police budgets investigating historic sex abuse amounted to spaffing money up the wall. And one colleague said you read him the Riot Act. I was just wondering, what's your version of the event?
I'm very conscious that what goes on in the voting lobby normally stays in the voting lobby. So all I can say is that I very much expressed my disappointment that he had used that word, particularly in the context of the subject matter. And I think it's a real shame, actually, because we're all understanding that the victims of child sexual exploitation may not be able to seek help, seek justice for many, many years, sometimes even decades after their traumatic experiences. And I think we should be supporting them rather than making them feel as though they don't deserve to be listened to. And this is precisely, you know, one of the reasons why the PM set up the independent inquiry into child sexual abuse. To uncover this.
And just at a time where there does seem to be a bit of a battle for the direction the Conservative Party should go in. I mean, you're often, I think, praised for having quite progressive politics, a liberal Conservative. I don't know who you would describe yourself as.
I think I'd be happy with that. Yeah.
What do you think the Conservative Party should stand for if we are going to start having that debate in a future, you know, leadership contest with people like Boris Johnson standing? What do you think the Conservative Party should represent?
I think we should represent modern Britain and the tolerance and the open arm approach to public life that the Conservatives have always had. It's one of the reasons why we're the oldest and most successful political party in the world. You know, Brexit is really important, don't get me wrong, but Brexit will happen and it's going to pass. And when it passes, we need to have ideas for the future. And this is where this sort of one nation progressive conservatism, where we're you know, no one is left behind. We're finding opportunities for people that perhaps don't exist at the moment. It's that sort of approach that I will be very much looking for in any future leader. It was really interesting. This week we had the knife crime summit at Number 10 to talk about knife crime, but also find new ways of tackling it on top of all the work we're doing at the moment. And I had the pleasure of hosting what I called the most positive roundtable, which was about opportunities for young people. Because it seems to me, of course, we've got to focus on law enforcement and tackling the gang leaders and so on this, but we've also got to make sure that we're able to offer something to the young people who are at the heart of this, who we're worried about, offer them opportunities for their future so that they're not steered onto a wrong path.
And then just to round up this podcast in the final section, just a few thoughts on current issues. And one is, I think you're quite rare in some sense for an MP because you don't have a social media account.
Well, I do. I'm not on Twitter. Okay. I came off Twitter, but
I don't have a Twitter account.
No, I'm on Instagram, but off Twitter.
Yeah, Instagram's a bit more calm, isn't
yes.
it?
It's much nicer. It's just more, you know, it's a friendlier place to hang out.
Yeah, speaking about Twitter, you said that you basically got rid of your account because you were fed up with death threats and nastiness from people who often live many, many hundreds of miles away from your constituency. Any regrets for not being on that? Or do you have a calmer life, would you say?
I have no regrets whatsoever.
Asking for a friend.
No regrets whatsoever. I think, you know, the point is, I don't have to listen or participate in any of the Twitter storms that flare up and seem incredibly important in the 5 minutes of the Twitter storm and then flare down again. And frankly, if something important does happen, you know, Westminster is quite gossipy, to put it mildly, so chances
and
are...
And you still have WhatsApp.
Yeah, oh God, yeah, of course, oh God. I've got to have WhatsApp. I mean, you know, it's all the gossip amongst the MPs. That's how we do it.
Just the only thing about the social media thing is obviously the the Conservative Party and the Labour Party have done some workshops about trying to help MPs, partly for welfare, but also because they see it as a new medium to reach out to younger voters and things. Do you feel like you're missing out on that at all by not having a Twitter account?
No, I mean, we looked...
Using this other ways.
We looked quite carefully at who was... And yeah. Please don't... You know, I was not going to break the internet with my Twitter number of Twitter followers. So of the few that were following me, when we looked at them, they were actually... vast majority were other MPs and other politicos, other journalists, you know, and a very, very few members of the public and very few constituents, actually. So we took the view that I wasn't, you know, I wasn't sure that the political world was going to not be able to cope having me on Twitter. So we came off it. And I don't regret it for a moment, I have to say. I really don't. And there's, you know, there are other ways of reaching out. And I think Instagram and podcasts like this, you know, it's all fantastic.
And in the chamber today, I was watching it while I was waiting for you to arrive. And you were doing a UQ on the gender pay gap. But in one of the questions after, you talked about the current atmosphere in Westminster and Parliament, which you think is putting women off. What did you mean by that?
I think anyone at the moment looking at the political climate understands it's not terribly comfortable and it's not very friendly. It's not very... it's not the sort of normal working environment that the vast majority of people are used to working in. And we have got to make sure that in all our conversations with each other that we're treating people with respect and with kindness, actually, and that we're, you know, there's more give and take than perhaps there's been thus far.
Now, one of the criticisms of Theresa May is that she's not that clubbable because she doesn't often go to bars and socialise in that sense. Do you think that you need to stay late in Westminster to be clubbable?
Oh, gosh. Well, look, I'm a working mum. So actually, I don't stay late and sit in bars. But I also make huge efforts to meet colleagues, to listen to their concerns in and amongst the working day. So, and I think that way you can make sure that you're accessible and people can get to know you. But you don't always have to stay late.
Yeah. On motherhood, I was wondering how you balance it with your duties. Well, another 2015 intaker, Fala, and Tom Tugendhat has said that he does the Today programme while changing nappies. Do you have such skill levels? Or
it was easier when Monty was younger. But no, I mean, I did the media round a couple of weeks ago. I did a media round in Millbank, which is where all the studios, for those who aren't familiar with Millbank, it's that all the different media companies have got studios in one building. And because I wasn't able to sort out childcare because it had come up very quickly. Monty was following me around in all the studios and reading his Horrible Histories book as he was sitting there very nonchalantly in television studios watching me do my thing. So he's very cool with that. He thinks that's what every mum does.
And then last two is worst advice you've ever been given.
So let's think about this. This is very good. Do you know, I actually was, when I was a young barrister, I had a much older male barrister say to me that I shouldn't show any weakness or vulnerability or any sense of how difficult the criminal bar was as a woman to others, because that would just undermine my reputation. And I mean, I didn't quite know what he meant by it at the time, but it stayed with me. And I thought, actually, on reflection, he was expecting me to pretend that I wasn't a woman working in what was still a male-dominated profession, and that I should, you know, be as tough as the men and so on. And I think nowadays I can't imagine anyone would give that advice, because we all have our own skills and weaknesses and so on. And I think actually being yourself is the most important, probably very cliched, but the most important thing you can be.
Finally, there's been some reports in the papers, with leadership speculation rife, that there are several colleagues and I think some in the cabinet who have said, and I paraphrase here, that they don't need to worry about having a woman leader next time because they've done it twice.
No.
Do you think that's a good way of looking at things?
I can't imagine any colleague has actually said that, but if they had said it, they have not said it in my presence, and probably wisely. Yes.
Thanks, Victoria.
Thanks so much.
And if you liked this podcast, why not subscribe? You can find all the episodes if you just go to www.spectator.co.uk/balls. And that will also lead you to the iTunes store, where if you really like it, you could leave a review. And they include interviews with Andrea Leadsom, Emma Barnett and Sarah Baxter of the Sunday Times. And we also have an offer you may have heard of if you've ever listened to a Spectator podcast before. And that is 12 issues for £12, along with a £20 John Lewis voucher, which is also valid in the supermarket Waitrose. Just go to www.spectator.co.uk/voucher.